I don't have to tell you that these are turbulent times. They're astonishing times. Many people are feeling deeply challenged, more reactive, and my sense is in more need of coaching than ever. And while these times are full of challenges, they're also ripe with evolutionary potential. This is the gift of these times. And I think it's these moments that coaches are built for, so we can help our clients unlock the deeper capacities and intelligence that's required of them now. And that's exactly what our newest program, Unlocking Leaders, is all about. You'll learn how to work at the source code of change, beyond strategy, beyond protocol, at the level of consciousness itself. This, for me, has been by far the biggest leverage I have with my clients. It's the most potent move I can make, because the level of consciousness a leader is operating from determines everything. What they notice, what they miss, whether they react defensively, stay grounded, whether they tighten in control or open into creativity and collaborativity, and ultimately what becomes possible in how they lead. And when you work at this level, you'll be able to tap into these hidden drivers behind decisions and behaviors and unlock possibilities in situations that once felt stuck. And beyond that, importantly, you're going to cultivate a capacity that AI will never possess. As AI expands and begins to dominate procedural and operational coaching, as it grows, it's becoming clearer what it cannot do. And it can't feel, it can't connect in the same way when two human beings come together and the field that they create becomes part of the transformational conversation. It can't work with consciousness, the very source of transformation and the source of the most powerful coaching moves. This is what separates good coaches from great coaches working at this level. And AI can't touch this. So if you're interested to find out more about this program, if you feel called to join us, then head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. The first class is June 16th with Jim Dethmer, just an incredible, masterful coach. And he's joined by Bob Anderson, also a true pioneer in the field of conscious leadership and coaching. And if you sign up by May 29th, you can get the early bird discount. Enrollment is open until June 12th. So head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. So yeah, I'm just really feeling, I'm trying to contain my excitement. We've just been checking in around what we're going to talk about. And we're going to be exploring this topic of love and power. And I'm joined by you, Adam and Jennifer. And maybe first of all, I can just invite you to see how you are. How's things right now? And you could maybe just give a little intro to who you are. Jennifer, you've been on our podcast a few times, but Adam, you're a first-time guest, so welcome. And yeah, maybe you could just introduce yourselves.
Well, I'm Adam Kahane from Montreal, now in Montreal. Spent the last 35 years facilitating conversations amongst, problem-solving conversations amongst people that often don't agree with or like or trust each other, all over the world on all kinds of issues, and in my spare time writing books about what I've learned from those experiences and from everyday life.
It's great to be here with both of you. I'm Jennifer Garvey Berger, and I am a coach and leadership thinker, writer, learner. And I spend my time either coaching senior executives or running leadership programs, those sorts of things. And I write also about the stuff I learn as we're engaged in these activities, particularly at the intersection of how does the inner complexity growing in us meet the complexity of the world outside? What happens when they don't meet and they crash into each other? And how do we grow what's going on in us to deal with what's going on out there? And so you asked Joel how we were doing. And a part of how I'm doing is struggling to grow what's in me to meet all that's coming out there.
I think you're not alone there, Jennifer. I think it's safe to say that. And, you know, of course, these two topics feel totally irrelevant for our times that we find ourselves in. In fact, I'm going to go there with our first question, but I just want to share, you know, I was just saying this before we hit record that I've been wanting to have Adam on the podcast for quite some time to talk about love and power. And then Jennifer, you reach out and you're like, hey, would you be open to hosting this conversation? So it's kind of been very synchronistic or fortuitous for me. So let me ask you, each of you, how are you making sense of our times right now? Then we can, I think, contextualize a little bit more why love and power feel like such essential ingredients for our times. You know, I mean, it's a huge question, I know, but what are you making sense of in the world these days? What's going on?
Adam, do you want to start there? Or do you want me to start?
Go ahead. Start.
You know, I feel like I'm making sense slowly of a world that's moving really quickly. To just try to, I feel incredibly excited to be alive right now. I feel like this is just an unbelievably fascinating and thrilling and terrifying moment in human history. And I'm trying to breathe it in. I'm trying to be with it. I'm trying to sit with the anxiety of it and notice what's running through my veins. And I'm turning to great conversations and walks through the woods and sometimes reading fantasy novels. I feel like right now I'm feeling all the things.
The granddaughter that introduced me to the expression feeling the feels, feeling all the feels. And I complimented her on the expression and the practice. And she told me it wasn't always a good thing. So, or it wasn't always a happy thing. I actually am going to answer by going back to what you said when you introduced yourself, Jennifer, because I think I'm coming at this, I don't know, maybe the same way, maybe the opposite way. I can't quite figure it out. I've always been, I've always paid a lot of attention to current affairs, and I've worked not on politics, but on political issues my whole career, from South Africa to Colombia to Canada to Myanmar. So these conflicts and what I'm noticing these days and writing about is falling apart. The phenomenon of falling apart. And I'm doing this while lots of things are happening in my big, boisterous family of, and I notice this rhythm in my family of falling apart, you know, fights or feuds or arguments. We're very spread out in all kinds of ways, geographically and politically and in generations, and then coming together. And I think at least conceptually, I'm perfectly comfortable with this rhythm of falling apart and coming together. But what I think's going on in the world is not that kind of rhythm. And the way I've been saying it is falling apart and coming together are fine, but falling apart, falling apart, falling apart, falling apart, and more falling apart, that gets dangerous. So that's what I'm focused on. And so I, uh, one of the podcasts I enjoy listening to is Ezra Klein. Last week or the week before, he interviewed, sorry, my memory for names is not very good, Pema Chodron. And I was very surprised in his introduction. He talked about himself and getting older. And he said, things are going to keep falling apart and coming back together. And I was really surprised that he was describing what was going on in his life and it, using the exact words that I'm using to describe the similarity and difference between what I see going on in my life and what I see going on in the bigger world. So that's the thing I'm been noticing and thinking about and trying to understand is, why do things fall apart and come together? And why would they just keep falling apart? And if that's not how you want things to be, then what can you do about it? And that's where, just a spoiler alert, I think power and love aren't enough of an explanation or a solution.
I'd love to keep that cliffhanger just for a little longer, because I'd love to just ask a follow-up to each of you around, does it, you know, if things keep falling apart, that feels kind of full on. And I wonder if, and this is my question, does this feel like a kind of systemic change where, you know, the system is perturbed? Obviously so, you know, like so many different challenges and crises we face. But in that perturbation is the kind of very seeds of what may emerge, you know, like the butterfly from the from this kind of the goo. It's very difficult to be human right now. But is the gift in this that's actually creating the conditions for the kind of change that we might need? And we don't know what it'll look like. That's the whole point. It's like it will be something quite different.
Well, you know, there is this very famous poem by Yeats, which has the expression that many people have used, things fall apart, the center cannot hold. So the idea that things are falling apart in a dangerous way is not new. And in fact, he wrote that, I think, just after the First World War. So this may not be, maybe this happens all the time, maybe it happens every so often. Certainly it's possible, I think, that things that can't or shouldn't or needn't hold together fall apart, and then they come together in a new and better, or at least more suitable way. But I don't think that's guaranteed.
Yeah, I think that's the question, right? That is the cliffhanger we're living in. Are we finding our way towards a new chapter in our evolution where we piece things together in a bigger way? Development is like this for individuals, right? We fall apart and then, and Adam, this is probably a piece of what you're writing about. We fall apart and then when we piece ourselves together, we are piecing together a more spacious version of ourselves. We've in the best cases, we've not just fallen apart, we've fallen into our next chapter, our next selves. Yeah. And then there are times when people just fall apart and it doesn't get better. They fall apart and it gets worse. And we certainly know that kind of falling apart, that's kind of permanent and terrible, is also an option. And so I think the question you're asking, Adam, about whether things are in a longer cycle so that it looks like they're falling apart, falling apart, falling apart on the way to coming together, or whether it's just, you know, kind of falling apart all the way down from here. I think, I don't know how we would know. I think we're living our way into that answer, right?
Yeah. And maybe one of the most important things to say is that it's not the same for everybody. Just like we'll all fall apart literally until we're worm food. And others will be born. So similarly or analogously, for some people, things are going to come together in a better way and for some people not. So that's important. Am I the first person who's used worm food on this podcast? I mean, that ought to be worth something.
You know, I don't know if that's like a metaphor or analogy. I'm not sure, but there's been a lot of different ones. Maybe it is. But maybe this is a good place to bring in the cliffhanger. We bring it back. You said, Adam, like love and power, maybe not enough. I think, was that how you said it? Could you talk a bit about, or could you set us up to talk about love and power? Yeah. Why they're important. And I think you said like they might not be enough as a pair. Yeah.
So let me riff on this for 3 or 4 minutes. And then Jennifer, I'm super curious as to, you know, how you understand it, including how you understand it differently. But I'll tell you how I've been thinking about it, because I have been thinking about it for a long time. I guess about 15 years ago, wrote a book called Power and Love, A Theory and Practice of Social Change. And it was this whole exploration or quest, if I can put it that way, that I started then and I'm still on now, was inspired by Otto Scharmer handing me a piece of paper. I don't remember the context, but I remember the piece of paper had printed on it a few sentences of one of the final speeches Martin Luther King Jr. made before he was assassinated. I think it was his final speech to the Southern Christian Leadership Convention. I think the title of the speech was, "Where Do We Go From Here?" And the sentence in it that is well known is, he said, I think it's important enough. I'm going to read it. He says, "Power properly understood is nothing but the ability to achieve purpose. It's the strength required to bring about social, political, and economic change. And one of the great problems of history is that the concepts of love and power have usually been contrasted as opposites, polar opposites, so that love is identified with the resignation of power and power with the denial of love. Now, we've got to get this thing right. What we need to realize is that power without love is reckless and abusive, and love without power is sentimental and anemic. It is precisely this collision of immoral power with powerless morality which constitutes the major crisis of our time." So sometimes you just read something and you're not even sure you know what it means, but you know it's really important. So that, what I've just read you, was the inspiration for writing the book Power and Love. And because what I thought and what I explore in that book is this polarization between people who focus on power and think that's the important thing, and people who focus on love and think that's the important thing. And what I noticed in my own work and my own experience was, I was in the love camp and was seeing the ways in which this was sentimental and anemic, and wanted to know how to balance the two of them. And I saw that a lot in the field of organizational development, multi-stakeholder dialogue, etc. One of the things I did when I was trying to make sense of that King quote, it's of course the problem with these words is power and love are used in so many different contexts. It's actually a little hard to talk about them because everybody has a different definition. But I went to the writing of Paul Tillich because King had wrote his doctoral dissertation on the work of Paul Tillich, and I discovered that Paul Tillich had written a book called Love, Power, and Justice, where he'd offered definitions that I think King had in mind when he said what he said, and that exactly fit what I was experiencing and trying to understand in my work. He said, love is the drive to unite the separated, and elsewhere he says, power is the drive of everything living to realize itself. So anyway, I focus on Paul Tillich, this German-American Protestant existential theologian, not because I'm super interested in German-American Protestant existential theology, but because I thought these definitions explain actually everything I was trying to understand. So, so I've gone a long way with that. Fast forward. I kept wondering, what's this justice thing? I know that that sounds like a foolish question, because in some ways justice or injustice has been at the center of my work throughout. Everybody I'm working with is trying to deal with something they think's not fair in the world, whether it's in South Africa or Colombia or Canada or Myanmar. So justice has always been there, but I'm almost finished. The Tillich book is a series of theology lectures, almost impenetrable for me, abstract theology lectures. And so I'm in this odd situation of having a book, I think I've got two or three copies that I'm always looking at, but that I understand and that I know is important. So to conclude, or to come to the punchline of the story, I think what's missing is you can talk about balancing power and love, and that was how my book Power and Love ended, talking about the need to balance like walking on 2 feet. That's the analogy I use, but I never said, what does it take to create the balance? It doesn't balance just because you want it to be balanced. And the clue in Tillich's book is he says justice is the form that enables power and love to both be expressed. So where I have gotten to, or where I'm at now, is the missing piece is the structure or the form or the culture or the rules of the game that enable us to reconcile everybody trying to realize themselves with everybody trying to unite the separated. You think about that for a few minutes, you realize that's not going to just work itself out. My favorite movie is The Big Lebowski, and my favorite line is in The Big Lebowski is when the dude says, or Walter says, this is not Nam here, there are rules. So what are the rules? What are the structures? What are the ways of organizing ourselves? And I'm looking at you, Jennifer, because maybe this sparks something in you that enable us to balance everybody trying to do their own thing with everybody trying to be with others.
I'm very excited to read your new book.
I'm very excited to write it.
That's a good feeling. That's such a good feeling. So I first came across your book as Cultivating Leadership was just forming. This is the leadership development firm I was starting with a couple of friends, not long before your book came out. And we were struggling with this question. And one day, one of my friends and co-founders and now housemate, Keith Johnston, said, this book has the answer. Everybody has to read this book. And in fact, we read it. We bought a billion copies of it, gave it to all our clients, said this is the answer to the universe. And we tried to kind of stumble our way forward into this lurching you describe of watching the leaning between power and love. This was before we had come across Barry Johnson's work in polarity management. And so it was the first polarity I ever really looked at and the first way of thinking about polarities I ever stumbled my way into. And then over time, you know, Adam, your work plays so beautifully with what are the structures that are needed to hold a thing. And my work often looks at internal structures, you know, what are the capacities, the internal capacities needed to hold the thing. And so we got like incredibly interested in power and love. Keith thought he would write a book about it. We did lots of reading. We did lots of talking. We did lots of exploration. And one of the people I talked to a lot was Bill Torbert about this question, because Bill Torbert talks about different forms of power as developmental impulses of power. And he and I would talk about, and he often talked with some of his other treasured collaborators about this question of love. Are there also different developmental impulses for love? And as we're all kind of having this conversation, I began to wonder whether the development, or somebody began to wonder, I was amongst the wanderers, whether this developmental impulse, so Torbert describes mutually transformative power as kind of the most fully formed internal capacity for power. And then we started to play with mutually transformative love as the most fully formed capacity for love. And the fact is they have the inner capacity to do exactly what you say. They require each other. You couldn't you couldn't be mutually transformative if you didn't have both of those features, I think. And so I learned so much from you about the outer conditions, what the structures and systems and habits could be that would set these things up. And I think a lot about these inner conditions and how do we grow into this capacity inside us. And of course, those things are completely either self-reinforcing or self-unreinforcing, right? This question of, can an external structure actually create a capacity in me, and can my internal capacities help create external structures? So I always thought the dance of our work would be in that space, because I'm fully convinced that the structures and habits you talk about are developmental. And I'm also fully convinced that the structures and habits, internal structures and habits that I talk about, have a developmental impulse to create these external conditions or communities or organizations. They organize at a higher level of capacities. And Joel, this is now you've got two theorists theorizing together. And so you might want to come in and good grab luck. Us by the ankles and pull us back down to the earth.
For sure. I'd love to, but I think I'd just love to right now just see what comes up for Adam here, if anything.
Yeah. So two questions. I guess one, What do you mean by, in your work or your thinking, by external and internal structures and habits? And then I've got another question, but let's start there.
Yeah. And what do I now mean?
Which is the word structure,
what I used to mean.
I think the word structure is very helpful, and my little understanding of systems thinking, the big lesson is that structure matters. But structure in the most general sense of the word, how things work around here, whether it's the physical geography or the laws or the power structures or the myths or. So I'm interested in what you mean by structure externally and internally.
So I think we agree on external structures. And I think about what's the structure of our meaning making. What are the laws, the rules, the habits, the assumptions that guide the thoughts that occur, the speech acts that we stumble upon, the solutions that arise for us. And so I get incredibly interested in this question about how do these external structures create what's possible in our meaning making? And then how does our meaning making begin to create external structures? And how does that work? If you have a really simple idea about a conflict, you have very complex ideas about conflict, but many people have very simple ideas about conflict and punishment and right and wrong and revenge or whatever it might come up for people. Those can be informed by structures that are inside, or they can be informed by habits or laws or ways of being that are outside, and those things reinforce each other, I think.
So what you mean by internal structure is?
The constellation of assumptions, habits, perspectives, those tend to constellate in ways that are themselves developmental.
The other question I wanted to ask you, for not very good reasons, I've always had a bit of an allergy to developmental approaches, mostly because, and maybe my reason is betrays my immaturity, but most of the people who've talked to me about developmental theories explain it to me by the fact that they're at the very highest level and sorry for the rest of us. And that's always rubbed me the wrong way. But leaving that aside, I guess I'm one. It seems to me that if there are developmental stages, then there's a lot of people going down, not up these days. And a lot of things in the world that are degenerative rather than generative. And I'm wondering how you think about that. If your professional work is all about helping people move up, why are so many people moving down?
I tend to think about it as for all of us, we have. Well, you talk about it in your work too. You talk about things that are generative and things that are degenerative, right? And I tend to think that. There are contexts that for each of us would help us be our kind of biggest, most spacious self, maybe even bring us to a next version of ourselves where we're better able to handle multiple perspectives, difference, diversity, conflict, all the things that are hard for us to handle, we have to grow into. And then there are contexts that tend to I've gotten really into the nervous system in the last few years because a triggered nervous system tends to bring a lot of those capacities offline. And when people's nervous system is triggered as often as right now brings to them, then the response from some kind of earlier place of self-protection or black and white thinking, or whatever it might be that would get us from this, like, from the scared or enraged part of ourselves, take some of our capacity away. So I think context can absolutely remove capacity. And right now the context is a lot. I mean, wherever right. you are, it's a lot. So this, the question of what are the systems and structures out there that create the conditions for whatever's in here to be more spacious and capable. And then how can what is in here produce something, even if it runs against the tide of the current moment, to create something more spacious and possible? This is the I don't know, curiosity I'm engaged in, life I'm engaged in.
Yeah. So what you've just said, I think is really important. And my explanation or my understanding about why we're seeing so much falling apart in so many places, in so many domains, for so many people, is that, and I'm sure you could say this better, but that when we're stressed or frightened, most of us tend to retreat to a smaller space within ourselves, a smaller group of people who, or place that feels safer, and to defend ourselves. And if lots of people are doing that most of the time, then you get smaller and smaller spaces. I had a conversation with a French economist a few years ago, a very brilliant man, and we were talking about the state of the world, and he said something that I never heard anybody say before, but I now think it was very insightful. He said, "I don't think the world's going to come to an end, but I do think we're entering a period of people working in smaller units." You know, that global would go to regional, regional would go to national, national would go to local. I think we're entering that period again. So that's what I see in this context, this frightening, dangerous context. What we're getting is more people associating with, more of us associating just with our people and away from those people. And that's my simple explanation for this phenomena of falling apart.
I'd love to bring in something here, like a reflection of my own. And then you can, you know, Jennifer, if you want to respond to what Adam said, ignore me, that's fine. Because what I'm sat with is I think I was one of those people in that in the love camp, you know. And I've seen around, you know, in the coaching community, spiritual communities, that is there a lack of impact here because we're not owning that the power side of polarity? And, you know, there's all these people here who are really good at that power side of things, and they don't really care about what we're saying because they're just doing their thing. So, you know, we need to get with it, you know, and so there's a kind of bringing together of those two poles. And what I'm sat with and wondering about, therefore, is like the role of justice, because I'm trying to make sense of, like, in me, I can feel that part of me that wants to retreat. But I can also feel something being called forth in me, which is, it's like we had this expression at my art school: when the going gets weird, the weird get going. And it's like I've never felt more inspired in my life, and it doesn't make sense to me, because, you know, if I look at the news and the world, I shouldn't feel inspired. And around me, I see people their hearts breaking open. And, you know, I feel called to serve. And so I wonder if this, you know, when I think of justice, is this like, and maybe this is my, maybe I'm talking about more about love and power, but is this like the intelligence of life, which orients around the good, the true, and the beautiful, and that, you know, feeling the feels, I don't know if you said that in the live recording, Adam, is like one of the invitations for us to be able to alchemize the discomfort and reorganize. So I guess I don't know if there's a question in there, but I'm wondering what is justice really like, and what does it make possible, and how does that link to, you know, everything you, Jennifer, and you are saying, you know, about this internal and external co-emergence, you know, of anyway. So just, yeah, don't know if that makes sense or stimulates anything.
I love this question. And we don't know what Adam thinks about it yet because we haven't read that book. And so we just have to ask him, Adam, tell us.
Yeah. So I think my biography informs my thinking about this. I grew up male, portably middle class, ambitious, individualistic. And so for me, power, the drive everything living to realize itself, is very easy to understand. I mean, I get it. I see it all around me. I think if you picked up today's newspaper, you probably would not be able to understand any of the stories if you didn't understand that drive. The drive of everything living to realize itself. My vocation is a love vocation. If love is the drive to unite the separated, that's what I do. That's what a facilitator does. Facilitator of multi-stakeholder diverse groups in conflict. That's it. Or that's at least the first move. You're bringing people together who don't want to be together, and you're helping them work stuff out. So I know about love, and I'm comfortable with power, or I get it. And so that's why the King speech or the excerpt from the King's speech struck me immediately as, yes, this is true and crucial. And so a lot of my writing has been to try to get love people to understand power. And in almost every one of my books, I have included the same quote from James Hillman, a psychologist, who says, why are the conflicts about power so ruthless, less so in business and politics when they're seen as an everyday matter than in the idealistic professions of clergy, medicine, the arts, teaching and nursing, to which I would add, and coaching and facilitating. In business and politics, it seems there is less idealism and more sense of shadow. Power is not repressed, but lived with as a daily companion. Moreover, it is now not declared to be the enemy of love. So long as the notion of power is itself corrupted by a romantic opposition with love, power will indeed corrupt. The corruption begins not in power, but in the ignorance of it. So I see that all the time. And so that's why I'm so interested in this balance, and therefore the question of what enables the balance. And I'm going to I'm beginning to think that in a conflict between power and love, power will always win, because it is, I'm not 100% sure that's correct, but I think it is, and I think it's because it is the drive of everything living to realize itself. It's the I'm alive drive. Me being alive is in most circumstances going to trump me uniting with others. Or to put it more exactly, I'm going to do the uniting with others at a smaller scale. And so that's where justice comes in. Justice in the normal use of the word as a legal concept, that it's the rules to work things out. Constitutions, laws, courts, police, there's differences, there's conflict, whether it's civil or criminal, and we need a way to work these things out because it comes up literally every day. But I'm using the word justice in a broader meaning than that, which is not just the legal meaning, but the rules of the game, the culture, the stories, that enable us to reconcile this permanent tension between each of us wanting to be ourselves and all of us wanting to be connected. That's not stable. And so that's my understanding of justice.
Yeah. And like, do you feel, therefore, that we are being invited to upgrade our sense of the rules of the game? What is justice? Is that kind of part of what is cooking right now? Or reimagine it, you know? Yeah.
There's this great article by, I think her name is Lydia Polgreen, a few days ago, the New York Times columnist, saying that all of this attention was paid to Stephen Miller's assertion about power and this famous line that, I'm not going to quote it correctly, that the strong will do what they want and the weak will suffer what they must. That this line, that this is, if you read the larger text, the author is saying the opposite, that that just doesn't work. And that that leads to ruin. So yes, I think that the narrow legal definition of justice is inadequate, and the idea that justice doesn't matter and that might makes right is ridiculous. So in both those senses, I guess I hadn't thought of it this way, but I guess what I'm really trying to do is, what's the word, revalorize justice?
I guess do you have a following question from there?
I have one, but please go ahead, Jennifer. Yeah.
You go.
It might take us off on a tangent. So actually I will just, you go, you riff with Adam here and I'll bring it in. Yeah.
Feel free to stop me or whatever, cut this section out if it's like too maniacally theoretical. The thing I've been thinking, Adam, is that in their highest forms, in their most expansive, life-giving forms, power and love become inextricable.
Mm-hmm.
They become so entwined that we use our unity in order to realize ourselves. And of course, if that impulse is alive, that makes a much bigger we, right? Yeah. That makes a larger and larger circle of concern, because if that's happening for me and you, then of course we want it to happen for Joel. And of course we want it to happen for all of our countries and all of our ecosystems, because we see the fundamental beauty, as Joel was saying, like the fundamental rightness of that unity. And I think each of us has like a profound felt experience of the disunity that you talk about, and how degenerative those are. And so I can't tell whether the thing you're saying is that when they come into unity, that unity is called justice, or whether you're saying they're actually a triangle, power, love, and justice, and that the triangular relationship of them brings this higher unity into presence.
That's what I'm saying, the second.
Got it.
So I think they are intertwined. I think they are yin-yang, literally. I think the definitions, or one version of yin-yang, is the creative and the receptive, the masculine and the feminine. So so yes, I think they are intertwined, but I'm arguing, and this is for me a new argument, I don't know whether it's correct, that they can't just reconcile, they won't stably reconcile. They need a third thing. They need a form or structure or rules or the way we do things around here. In the absence of that, they'll fall apart. And so the riddle I have, and I really don't know the answer, and this I'm hoping before this podcast is over, you will give me the answer, one or both of you, is what does that look like? What is the, if I say form, structure, rules of the game, culture, the way we do things around here, that reconcile power and love, that reconcile everybody trying to be themselves and everybody trying to unite at least with certain others. What does that look like? I really need that, please. It's the missing chapter. And so,
have an answer, but
well then,
Joel, that's so disappointing.
What good is this? I'm so disappointed, Joel.
I feel it might come, but I think what I want to share is that it's it feels like you're articulating one of the core tensions, you know, that people are feeling. Let me say a bit more. Like it feels like modernity maybe is kind of like privileged a hyper individualistic sense of self, atomized sense of self. And there are all kinds of issues with that. And, and our disconnection from nature, meaning crisis, many kinds of issues. And that at least, and again, it's not an answer, but one common thing that I feel and I see people speaking to is just this yearning for a deeper communion, to recognize our interdependence, but not in a way that squishes that we're individuals, but that it feels like we've tipped kind of way too far on one side. And so is that justice that's wanting to, it's kind of, it all feels kind of mushed together, but is it an identity shift that allows the new, that kind of vivification of justice again, or is it the justice that allows the shift into a kind of more mutually sustainable way of living and thriving to emerge? So, yeah.
I'm going to say, unless you're right in the middle of solving this problem, Adam, I'd like to riff just a little bit on a couple of things that we've learned actually not so much my organizational work, but in my life work here, because you both know that some years ago, a bunch of us bought this big house together and we live in community here. And one of the things I sometimes write about are, and people are asking me all the time about, what rules do you follow as you live in community together? So I've written about this some. And it is true that the rules that you follow when living in community have to be reforged, because the rules that we follow in our everyday modern lives, as Joel points out, are much more individualistic, much more about my rights, much more about my kind of taking up the space I want, and I'm going to push it to the edge until something prevents me from from taking up more space. But the rules in community are different. Right? You have to, you actually have to consider much more often the us. You have to consider the us as much as you consider the I. And people are always asking, when they ask us about how does this whole thing work, you can always hear in their questions the, like, how do you get enough I, right? Like, when you move into community, how do you get enough I? And one of the things I've learned since moving here is almost nobody asks that question any other way about their regular, you know, the kind of more ordinary way people live. Nobody says, oh, I wonder how I could consider the we more often when I'm, you know, loading the dishwasher. And so how do you defend your I space is really like a classic question, but how do we weave together is a much less, much less kind of tripping to the tip of the tongue question. And it makes me wonder about what you're saying, Joel, is are there a new set of rules, a new justice that needs to be born in order to correct the overleaning that you're both describing?
Yeah, that's really, really helpful, Jennifer, that example. Thank you. And I'm not at all a constitutional expert, but I do remember, or I do know, that in South African jurisprudence, I think unlike American jurisprudence, this question of, I think it's called positive rights as well as negative rights, you know, the right to health, the right to housing, these are us rights. And the idea that the only rights that matter are individual rights. Sorry, I think I'm not explaining this accurately, but I think there are, even in the law, there's more than one kind of right, and there are societies that balance that legally. And I think your example is super important, and to go back to the way Joel asked the question, yes, I think the role of justice is to prevent both extremes. You know this Greek myth of Scylla and Charybdis? Okay, so it's a famous story. I think Homer, maybe I'm getting it wrong. Anyhow, there's a certain narrow strait of body of water, and on one side is a, And each side has a monster on it called Scylla and Charybdis. One's represented by rocks, the other by a whirlpool. And you have to steer very carefully, because if you try inexpertly to get away from the rocks, you'll end up in the whirlpool and the opposite. So this notion of between Scylla and Charybdis, And I think justice is between Scylla and Charybdis. So what are the two social monsters? One monster is everybody's just doing what they want to do, and lots of people are getting hurt. And we see a lot of that in the world these days. The other social monster is unity and collectivism above all, and you're an authoritarian or dictatorial or totalitarian. So yes, I think justice is about steering that middle ground. And I think you're both right that we're used to trying to safeguard the I, and so the adjustment, which may already be present, for example, in South African jurisprudence about safeguarding the we.
I'd love to bring in a question here about justice comes from, in the sense of, you know, we could use your example, Jennifer, of the, you know, your community or other examples. You know, it's something I've been thinking about as well is, and I know that's not precisely what we're talking about here, but how can we have a kind of response to injustice that doesn't create more polarization itself, you know, and kind of jam things up, you know, because it feels like there's a lot of that going on, and, you know, particularly social media has increased that. So I'm just wondering, you know, where does justice come from then? You know, Jennifer, like, did you sit down, you know, how might this apply in cultural change, societal change or organizations? But did you sit down, Jennifer, and kind of, you know, what was that process to, was there a set of rules you created, or was it more like heuristics and principles?
Well, in this case, we waited to see what kind of rules needed to happen, right? Like where the friction points were, where the difficulties were. We actually didn't make any rules before we, you know, bought the house and moved in, which might sound nutty. We created a list of things we didn't want to happen. Like we tried to disentangle money from power, for example. And so we had these, but I would call those almost values. And then as we found tension points, we started to name the rules that many of us were already starting to live by, but that needed to be spoken aloud in order for us to all like link arms and say, yes, we agree to that. And we don't have very many of them. And they're almost all about how we balance this question of the I-ness and the we-ness, right? Like how do we manage that, and how do we talk about and make sense of the different forms of power different ones of us have? How do we increase, you know, Heidi Brooks talks about like increasing speakability. How do we constantly increase speakability about these things? Because I don't know, I wonder if there's something in this kind of elevated form of justice that makes it possible for more people to speak into and listen into the different perspectives across these differences. Because without that, you know, so we have like rules about speaking from sensation and not story, for example. Because if I speak about what's true for me in my body, before I, you know, pack it with a bunch of stories that are probably about you and how you've harmed me or how you've done something terrible, this one is more capturable and more reachable, because I don't know how much of it's me and how much of it's you. You know, between us, there's 100%, but I don't know. In the moment, it always feels like it's you and it's not me at all when I'm having a thing. Or for some people, it always feels like it's me and it's not you at all when I'm having a thing, right? So like finding a way to negotiate that, we've had to find rules about, because there are unusual ways of being in relationship to each other. And so I think we've had to codify some of these unusual ways and say, okay, we're going to agree to that. Yeah, we agree to that. But there aren't very many of them for us. Not so far. We're what, 5 years in, but there aren't that many of them.
Yeah. So I think it's a wonderful example, Jennifer, really. And you talk about balancing I-ness and we-ness. Here's how I would offer to complicate that, but it might hit. So this is important where my thinking is going, and I'm curious what this complication brings up for you. I would say balancing three things: wholeness, which is we're each whole in ourselves, that's the I-ness. Partness, the fact that we're each parts of larger wholes, that confusingly is we-ness. But I think there's a third dimension, which is the fact that we're kin, we're interrelated. And it's been helpful for me to separate the fact that I'm part of a larger whole and we're all needed to make this house work. And if you don't empty the dishwasher, then that's more work for me. That's not the same phenomena as we're fellow beings, we're kin. So I'm talking now about wholeness, partness, and interrelatedness, which correspond to power, love, and justice. But I'm just curious. I know that what I've said is abstract, but I'm curious what that third dimension sparks in thinking about your home experiment.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if this is the same. The way I hear you is sort of the polarity of independence and dependence, which I think has like a meta unity in interdependence, is one of the ways I hear you. Like one of the ways my mind translates what you're saying. What we talk about is, which might be a different way of understanding it. There's me, there's us, and then there's the relationship itself, which is a third thing between us. Mm-hmm. And if I'm helping to nurture, one of the things we agree to is we help to nurture this third thing between us. That's part of our commitment, is that that third thing is a, like, has beingness, and we can pour goodness into that beingness, or we can starve it. And our agreement is, and turning away from it, you were talking about turning away, turning in, turning away tends to starve the beingness. And so one of our commitments is a turning toward commitment, that we, when we are feeling capable, which sometimes we're not, sometimes like what you're capable of is going into your room and eating your dinner at your desk, right? And not going down to the big table downstairs where we have dinner together every night. Sometimes you just can't face it. Because of whatever, and that's okay too. But the march over time has to be a turning towards march, or else because these micro falling together and falling apart moves are fine, they're regular, but you want the meta move to be a together move, the larger arc. You want to be a together arc and not a away arc. And I think the reinforcing feedback loops, as you were saying earlier, of turning away, there becomes less and less to turn towards. as you turn away. And so it's harder. It's like much less gravitational pull there.
And I guess you might know that that metaphor is, I think, the key instruction from John Gottman's marriage, books about marriage, is turning towards.
Yeah.
Well, I'm really looking forward to finding what you've written about that experiment, because I think it's a great example. I think the thing we're thinking about differently, and there's so many ways to make these lists of three, is for me, interdependence and kinship are not the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the big question in my family, my extended family, it's not really interdependence. It's not that we are a team and we need each other. I mean, in some minor ways, that's true, but we're together not because we're a team or that we need each other. We're together because we're family, period.
As we come towards the end of our time as well, I think of what is it in you, Jennifer, and you coming together in this community that has you decide to turn toward rather than away? And then I think of like our species, and I think, you know, and I don't want to get like idealistic or utopian, but I think there is something in me that kind of believes that it even if things get really difficult and challenging, ultimately we will then decide to turn towards in some way. Maybe even because things got incredibly difficult and we were all turning away and that didn't work. Anyway, I just wonder what that is in you that has you decide to turn towards, you know, like that you must value that. You must feel, like a good thing to do.
I think it's a value we're trying to live into. It's always easier to turn away. It's always easier to not have the conversation, to be pissed off, to atomize into smaller and smaller groups. And that's so not working. Like, it's so bad. And so this commitment that says we're going to pull against the gravitational force of that in order to see whether you could create something significantly better by simply resisting that form of gravity and trying to, with the force of, I think, maybe this is justice, with the force of habit or rules, turn towards a thing that's more difficult. And then that becomes a self-reinforcing cycle, because every time we do that, it actually really does get better. Our relationships do get better. Everything gets better. And we get bigger. We get more spacious. We get better able to hold each other through the difficulty. And that little feedback loop is really pleasant, right? It makes life much, much better. So there is something in me that says, and maybe this is your justice, that if you have a rule about that and you put your hand over your heart and you say, I believe that this is a good, I believe that this is hard, and I'm going to try desperately hard to live into it. I will fail on any number of occasions, but I will try and I will try and I will try again. I will keep turning towards the turning towards. And if that's the rule, then it works. Or it's worked so far.
So at the risk of ending the podcast on a super difficult conundrum, I think there's a real question of scale here. And so you asked the question, Joel, if things really get, I think you said more or less, isn't it true that when things really get bad, we'll come towards? I think the general answer is yes, on a small scale. And Jennifer's answer was a very small scale answer. Some people have chosen to live in a house together, which I think is which is important, but doesn't at all guarantee that this will work at the village level, let alone the national or global level. I was rereading this morning a book that used to be very famous. It has an odd title. It's by, I think, Reinhold Niebuhr, who was a contemporary of Tillich, and the book is called Moral Man and Immoral Society. I think that's the title. And it's a shocking book to read, because it says that it's all about the fact that you can have perfectly moral and good people in their private or family lives who do terrible things at larger scale. So it's one of these books that's written in a style that isn't fashionable anymore, that's very hard to make your way through. But that idea is important. And so I think that's the conundrum, is we know what this looks like at a small scale, a workshop, a management team, a couple, a communal house. But what would that, how would you do that? Or how do we do that at larger scales?
Well, maybe that tees up, you know, part two at some point when we when we know that, if we're still around at that point. I love finishing at that question. You know, it's brilliant, because it's the question. It's a vital question, isn't it? You know, in a way, we're living into it, and with all the messiness and the excitement and the adventure and the challenge that brings. So I just want to thank each of you for being in this conversation. And I don't know if you want to point people towards anything like your work or how you want to end, if you want to share anything else, but it's been a real pleasure for me to be in this dialogue and exploration together.
It's been a real pleasure for me too. If people are interested in more about what I call the French experiment, I do write about it on both my personal blog, which is 25,000dawns.com, and also on the Cultivating Leadership blog, cultivatingleadership.com. And you should absolutely read Adam's books, because they're extraordinary. And we have designed Cultivating Leadership around some of these questions. And I think about them most days. So this is a very lasting impact. And I think that I just want to say before we go that the question you're asking, Adam, about how do we do this at bigger scales, I'm not sure we've ever had to figure it out as a species before, because I'm not sure we ever had the kind of global enmeshment we have right now. Or the capacity to really, it's been these last kind of 100 years that we've had the capacity to really seriously mess things up at a global scale. But now we can do it, you know. Go team. And so we have to figure out how to answer this question that you're asking. It is it's the most imperative question of our time. So I'm hoping that you are writing every day, and that soon your book will guide us home.
Okay. Well, thank you both. This has been super useful. In the video, it probably shows my head down a lot because I've been taking a lot of notes. It's really exceeded my expectation. So thank you both. And I would love to do a follow-up, Joel, on that question. Because yes, it's true what you say about the global level, various global existential threats. But I think we've been dealing with this, at scales smaller than the globe and bigger than the household for a long time. And we're, in many cases, not doing well there either. The city, the region, the organization. So, I remain fascinated with how cultivating leadership is working with these things in your client organizations, which is another larger scale.
And stories there too.
Yes. So there's lots more to talk about. Yes, I'm working on this, but if people are interested in the practice that underlies this theorizing, that's what Rios Partners does, riospartners.com. And I've written 6 books leading up to this that you'll find on that same website. And I'm constantly asking questions and inviting contributions in this exploration, mostly on LinkedIn. So thank you so much, both of you. Yeah. I wrote down acknowledge Joel and Jennifer.
Right. Well, there you go. It was a pithy, to the point acknowledgement. I love it.
No, I mean in the book. I wrote the book.
In the book. All right. I thought you were just meant. I thought that was it at the end. Thank you.
That was it. He did it.
Beautiful.
Thanks for tuning into the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. And a reminder that the early bird enrollment is now open for our upcoming live training with Jim Dethmer and Bob Anderson. It's called Unlocking Leaders, and it's going to teach you how to coach at the level of consciousness, which is, for me, the highest leverage move you can make as a coach. Your client's consciousness is the place where the deepest, truest transformational breakthroughs come from. And often traditional coaching misses this. And it's something that our clients need us to learn as coaches. Because our times are calling for something deeper. We've got to go beneath the content of our experience, beneath strategy, to the source of change. And that's exactly what Unlocking Leaders is designed to teach you. I'm so proud of this program, of what it's become. I feel it's our offering in these times. And if you're ready to answer the call of these times, then you can join the full program. So just head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. And remember, you can get the early bird discount if you join by 29th of May. Here we are. We're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com, put your name in the sign-up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.